bring you coffee.
Well, I just made a fresh cup. Thank you.
So you and I think the last time we actually spent time together was in France. I think we were at the Le Column d'Or restaurant, St. Paul du Vence.
Yes, quite a few years ago.
Yeah, and I remember that dinner we had like it was yesterday, because I haven't eaten. I haven't ordered rabbit on the menu since, because I don't know if you remember, Peter, but I literally they had this rabbit special, and I said, yeah, that I'll have that. And a little time went by, maybe a couple of minutes, and then you took your fingers and you did ears on the top of your head, and you just kept doing it. And I looked at you, I said, it's the rabbit, isn't it? And you said, yeah. And I said, excuse me, waiter, I'd like to cancel the rabbit.
It's funny, of all the different things I eat, it's a rabbit really, you know, I tried it once. I couldn't get through one or two bites. You know, probably tastes like chicken for all I know. I don't know.
Yeah, it does. but you know, I've actually told that story many times where someone will order rabbit and I'll do to them what you did to me, and then it'll start that discussion of the dinner meeting you and I had in France. I wind up not ordering it.
I hope that whatever you ordered instead was still delicious.
I think it was, like the vegetarians like to say, it was probably it's probably something that some food that did not have a mother.
Well, sorry about that.
Well, and the other thing I was going to mention to you is, you know, we both grew up in South Jersey, my dad lived in Toms River, which wasn't too far from where you grew up.
Toms River.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that, you know, I followed your career over the years, and especially early on, if you don't mind, we can start there. I know your father was very, very supportive of you becoming a musician, which was kind of interesting from a dad who was a physician. Tell me about that experience that took you at such a young age to literally what I've learned, hung out with campers that are some of the greatest jazz artists today.
Well, he was a physician. He became a psychiatrist by the time I was born. But before that, he was a bass player. Mm-hmm. And playing the bass was how he paid his way through college and medical school. He had a band that he called Fred Erskine and His Music for Moderns. So, you know, he was into jazz, and I'm certain that he wanted all four of his children to discover music and have it be an important part of their lives. So everyone, you know, took lessons, but I seemed to be the one that was the most interested. And, mm-hmm. and I've said before that the little drum set that he fashioned for me out of a conga drum and a sizzle cymbal, a very small sizzle cymbal, these two items function not only as a drum set, but also as a sort of compass. So as far back as I can remember, Michael, this is what I knew I would be doing for the rest of my life. And I'm 62 now, so it's been quite a few years I've been playing the drums, and I'm just beginning to get to the comfort level with the instrument that I long kind of dreamt about. And that's not a bit of false modesty or something. I've always loved playing the drums, but it's just recently that I've been able to feel such a how should I put it? Effortless is maybe not the right word, but it's what comes to mind. It's kind of effortless connection to the instrument.
Yeah, and do you think it's because, you know, with age, with maturity, you kind of found your center?
Undoubtedly. I mean, and that's a process that truly began once I was married and started raising a family. Mm-hmm. I think just, you know, you get enough flying hours mm-hmm. under your belt, and after a while you really do know how to land the plane.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I, you know, I, like your dad, I'm a physician, and I want my kids to be involved in music, but I don't think of them as becoming professional musicians. I want music to be part of their lives because I've seen in my almost 60 years how enriching it is for your life, and I don't want them to miss out on that. It does. There's a major leap from someone who can appreciate music and even as a player to commit their professional life the way you did in such a way.
Well, you've given you know, your children a great gift by orienting their upbringing like that, and in fact, you're quite similar to my dad in that. I think his master plan, he was hoping that I would also become a psychiatrist and be a jazz musician, let's say along the lines of Denny Zeitlin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my father used to, he said, look, you know, Denny Zeitlin has a great career playing jazz piano, but he's a doctor. And my father wanted me to go to medical school. when I was going to high school up at the Interlochen Arts Academy, which was like a, you know, an answer from heaven or a gift from the gods to be able to leave the small town in New Jersey that only had a marching band in the high school program to this high school in the middle of the country, albeit very far north, but had a symphony orchestra, percussion ensemble, concert band, jazz band, and every student there was just like me, you know, instead of being the oddball, which was okay in junior high school, you know, to be the little musical celebrity. But anyway, the high school had an accelerated 3-year program, and my father was satisfied with my educational ambitions when I got out of high school early with the stated objective of starting my college career at Indiana University, you know, that 1 year earlier so I could get my Doctor of Music degree. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be a doctor one way or the other. you know, and then as soon as I finished that first year of college and I just turned 18, I got the chance to go on the road with Stan Kenton, and I became a college dropout. So I did eventually get the doctorate, an honorary degree from Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, even though it's an honorary degree from Berkeley, I think between you and me, it was an honorary degree thanks to Gary Burton, who I think was the sole member of the committee that decided that stuff back in those days.
Well, now, speaking of Gary, you know, the story that I've heard is that Gary and Randy Brecker and Sanborn and Keith Jarrett, they were all fellow campers with you during these music camps that you would go to as a, you know, before the age of 10.
Oh, yeah. So my first camp, my mom and drum teacher, John Civera, Civera, mm-hmm. they applied to this National Stage Band camp. And of course, you couldn't call it a jazz camp back in the late 50s or early 60s. The very first National Stage Band camp was in 1959 on the campus of Michigan State University. Mm-hmm. I think in 1960 they held a camp in Bloomington, Indiana. So I went to the 1961 camp. I just turned 7 by the time I got there. There was a bit of a lapse in communication, and they didn't realize, or someone didn't realize, that I wasn't the minimum required age. I wasn't 14 years old. And so, they were a little bit shocked when we arrived, but luckily someone had a sense of compassion. Like, well, these folks just drove from New Jersey to Indiana. And keep in mind, this is before the interstate highway system was nearly complete.
Sure, back roads.
Yeah, I mean, Wheeling, West Virginia, wow. So
you've not recovered from that.
No, not, it's traumatic sitting in the back seat of the car. I might have been in the front seat. Anyway, so it was arranged that I would play personally for Stan that first night of the camp, the arrival day. Stan was savvy enough to have a photographer from the local newspaper come to this audition. I think he'd already made up my mind if I could play the drums at all, I'd be allowed to stay. And indeed, my photo appeared in newspapers and on wire services. The youngest student at this camp. Thus began my association with Stan Kenton. I'm barely old enough to go on the road, and he invites me into his band. Again, I think for press savvy reasons as much as anything else, the Kenton audience was, we played a lot of schools, and young kids dug it that here was this long-haired drummer that they could identify with that's playing with this big band that had a lot of older people in it. Mm-hmm. In fact, Stan was quite upset when I cut my hair for the first time, which surprised me because he was such a conservative. Anyway, so at this first camp, when I look at the photo, now Gary Burton had been at the previous camps, but that's all anyone could talk about was this vibraphone player, Gary Burton. In this photo, you can see Keith Jarrett, Don Grolnick, David Sanborn, Lou Marini Jr., Jim McNeely, Randy Brecker. I'm not sure if he was at that camp. I know he was at the 1962 camp. Mm-hmm. A lot of names that jazz's readers will, of course, recognize. This became the jazz fix for young musicians, and it was a key part of getting jazz into schools. Mm-hmm. So I did it for quite a few summers. Eventually, a camp began to take place. It was held in Connecticut, in Storrs, Storrs, University of Connecticut. The instructors were incredible. Alan Dawson, Ron Carter, Jimmy Garrison, Ray Santisi, a lot of the Berklee faculty at that camp, Oliver Nelson. To be around these people, let alone these heroes. I mean, these were the names and the men who were making all the albums that I spent hours every day listening to and looking at the photos. They all were so giving, you know, in terms of like kind of paying it forward, providing information that it's the way I've known almost all the great jazz musicians to be. Mm-hmm. That's just the way they are, and certainly drummers. They love to share the knowledge and the passion and the enthusiasm. Jazz musicians, some do it more gently or gracefully than others, but it is about passing the craft and the passion down to the next generation or generations of players.
And you know, the thing that I find fascinating about as I followed you over the years is, you know, it's clear when you talk about music, certainly so many instructional videos and sort of in the academic area that you've been involved in, you're an academic, but you're far from being a purist.
A tourist or a purist?
no, in the sense of pure jazz. You're not a purist, and yet sometimes that's when academicians tend to lean more purist, and you go in the other direction.
You know, I'll be honest, Michael, I never thought of that. Because, you know, I was very lucky to just, circumstance had it, you know, to be born in 1954. And recorded music just seemed to be going through such a fascinating, not only period of development, but almost, you know, a spasm of creativity.
Almost the birth of album-oriented repertoire.
Yeah, exactly. And you had, then of course the Beatles came along. I was more of an R&B guy when the Beatles came around, but I liked the Beatles. And I liked the melodies, and I loved the sophisticated simplicity of what they did. I have to admit, I was a bit of a jazz snob, and I would wonder, like, you know, I'd see the Doors on Ed Sullivan, and I'd think, why would they sound like an Elvin was playing with them? But of course, I came to understand and appreciate just how perfect the drummer Ringo was for the Beatles, and how perfect a drummer John Densmore was for the Doors. And you know, at one of these camps, the composer and arranger Johnny Richards was working with the Kenton Band. He was one of the teachers, and he led a student band. Johnny was responsible for writing the arrangements of the Kenton West Side Story album, and he composed the Cuban Fire Suite, Adventures in Time, and then he had his own big band in New York. So Johnny was a dashing figure, or striking figure, I should say. Bald-headed gentleman with some girth and heft, and his wife used to make him these outlandish kind of, almost like ponchos, but they were sort of like dashikis before dashikis came to being. So he was just, wow, this guy's wild, and the music was very difficult to play and challenging to listen to, but I was a big fan. Anyway, a remarkably gentle man, despite this first impression you might get from his appearance. And he knelt down at the end of one of these camps, and I would always be a sobbing, crying mess because I just didn't want to say goodbye to any of these people. At the end of the week, I just fall in love with everyone. And he really started it. He knelt down near the end of the final concert and embraced me, put a hand on each shoulder, and he looked me in the eye, so he's eye level. That's the kind of people these people were. They would talk to you at eye level, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And he said, Peter, be sure to listen to every kind of music. So I took that as almost like directions from God. I mean, you know, that was okay. And I already was interested in lots of different things, so that just kept me on that path of seeking out music from all over the world and trying to understand, and of course that feeds your passion for it. And so I found that one genre, let's say, or playing experience would inform the next.
Mm-hmm.
So as simple as that. Sorry to put it in so many words.
No, but that really, to me, and I think to listeners and our readers, explains the connection between Jan Garbrecht, Weather Report, and Steely Dan's Hey 19.
Exactly. And you know, like Manfred Eicher, when by the way, that new 4-box set is just coming out, which I'm so pleased to see.
Yeah. In fact, I wanted to talk about that in a minute.
But Manfred was quite concerned when I was working with him. You know, we did over a dozen recordings in collaboration. He had extreme reservations about my doing other kind of recordings, whether it was playing on a GRP album, the Steely Dan tour was a good example. And you mentioned Garbrecht. I mean, Miroslav thought it unforgivable that I was doing that. And I asked for his blessing because I wanted the guys to still be cool. And he said, "You're asking my blessings? No." I'm in New York minding my own business. I talk about this in my book, No Beethoven. I'm walking down the street and some guys go, "Hey, Peter Erskine, right?" And "Hey, fellas." You know, a couple of young guys with gig bags. And one of them says, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." And he comes up and he goes, "What the fuck are you doing playing on a David Benoit record?" You know, I paying the bills, guys. But, you know, I became a better ECM drummer for having played on a David Benoit record.
Sure.
And Manfred didn't want to try to understand that or accept it. But I know it to be true. In other words, what I was seeking out, Michael, and all these different experiences was in my own circuitous way to try to get a better understanding of the craft of making music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really have like a dichotomy where this is art and this is not. So for me, it's all art. Whatever the purpose is, art doesn't mean that I have to overplay or I have to do this or do that. And the variety keeps the dullness from setting in. I never, mm-hmm. I feel so lucky because I'm never like resentful of a piece of music I'm playing or envious of what someone else is playing.
Mm-hmm.
I can look around, admire it, and if I want to do it, I'll try it. Passion is a good thing, envy is not.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like passion is definitely the overriding thing, as well as the quest to learn. I mean, I think most teachers would probably admit that the reason they like to teach is that that's how they learn. And my father was a terrific example too. I mean, he liked teaching, and I liked watching him teach, not just me, but my friends and stuff, or my siblings. So,
yeah, I think as a physician, as I'm sure you saw in your father, you're constantly learning, and the way you get better, it's no different than, you know, I'm only assuming since I'm the self-proclaimed worst guitarist in the world, but you absolutely learn as you teach, and that's the way you get better.
And yeah, I mean, as a physician, men and women, doctors can't stop learning, right? I mean, you'd be derelict in your responsibility, and you know, I'm not as good at keeping up as I was when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have my finger on the pulse of, that I think that's there are some jazzers. I mean, Herbie would be a great example, but Herbie is so far above most mortals.
Yeah.
But Herbie has the ears and somehow the ability to keep current. I feel like, you know, I'm trying to, but I some of the newer stuff I'm not quite hearing, and that's why I want to stay open minded, but I also at this stage of my life, I kind of just want to listen to and enjoy the music I enjoy listening to. And what's interesting is, as I'm getting older, I'm actually going further back. I'm really beginning to understand older music.
Yeah.
Not understand it intellectually, just like understand it in terms of how to enjoy it.
I don't appreciate it. I had a conversation the other day with Tommy LaPuma, and he said the exact same thing. He said, you know, as odd as it may sound, I am so enjoying going back and listening to things that I didn't carefully listen to back in my earlier days.
Interesting.
And I'm appreciating it at a different level. And I think that's what happens. I mean, there's no doubt about it. With your experience with, 500 plus albums you've been on?
700
now. Jeez. Yeah. So you can go back and listen to things maybe differently than you would have 25 years ago.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I don't listen too much to myself. Although I had an interesting experience. Without going into details, I was speaking with a writer, and I was talking about this just the worst album experience. I played so horribly, and when I saw the arranger years later, I apologized, and he was just being a gentleman because he said, I'm not sure what you're talking about, but I said, I felt like I really let you down, and blah, blah, blah. So this guy goes, okay, I got to hear it. I said, no, I've never played it for you. And he said, no, come on. You've talked about it so much. Find a record. Let's listen to it. Oh my God. Okay. So I find it and I put it on and we're listening. And then we both kind of looked at each other and went, hey, you know what? It actually sounds pretty okay.
That's not so bad.
No, that's actually pretty good. Holy cow. So we tend to be, either our biggest fans or our own worst critics, usually our own worst critics. And now I seem to have a better handle on, maybe that's why the playing seems easier, because I'm just not second guessing it so much, and I'm also not worrying about what kind of impression I'm making on someone. That's such a detour, a musical detour, what's the word? Medical, looking for a medical term.
A distraction?
A distraction? That's not medical enough, Michael.
Oh, okay.
Not symptom, not anxiety. So it's almost a neurotic.
Oh, okay. So you're talking, now you're going back to your dad. You're going psychiatric on me.
Sorry. but yeah, you get a neurotic anxiety about... how am I doing? Does the musician I'm working with, does he or she like my playing? The musician has just walked into the room. Do they like me? And I finally realized two things. One is that if someone's listening to you, it's just kind of an honor that they're there listening. And if they like it, great, you know. But if they don't, it doesn't change how you sound. Right. And there's nothing you can do about if someone likes it or not. That's not the point. The point is to create the music, serve your musical colleagues the best you can, and play what you'd like to hear. I mean, it's very simple.
Would you, and I guess to oblige to your medical terminology, would you say that maybe the highest level of anxiety that you had experience with that may have been with Joe Zawinul?
But you know, Michael, you're breaking up all of a sudden. Hold on. Are you there?
So I'll repeat the question.
Michael, you know what? I lost about the last minute.
I think it may be an internet connection thing. I was going to say that, would you say kind of using your request for some medical terminology, maybe the level of anxiety for you may have peaked during your maybe time with Joe Zawinul?
My level of neuroses may have peaked. Yeah, I mean, that was a real machismo, chest-thumping proving ground, a kind of a combination of hardcore jazz bebop machismo meeting Zawinul's Nietzschean, I don't want to say obsession, but you know, this oddly somehow, even though he was Austrian, it's oddly got a Germanic sense of I don't know what. It was a strange combination. And what's funny, because, you know, joining Weather Report, and I never put myself at the top of the list of my favorite Weather Report drummers. You know, I had a fantasy of what it might be like, and I had a blast doing it. I loved it, and I'm forever grateful for it. But it was a slightly different band than I imagined it would be when I used to fantasize, what if I ever played with Weather Report? Because I primarily heard the band through the sort of the keyhole or prism of the ways that, like, Eric Gravatt and Alphonse Mouzon had played with the band. Mm-hmm. Kind of up to Mysterious Traveler. It was starting to get funky. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, I liked Weather Report, but I wasn't kind of as passionately following it until I heard Heavy Weather. And then I told Jocko when he played for me, I said, this is the version of the band I've been waiting for all my life. And because Alex, there was a lightness to his playing, and just there was a sparkling quality to it. And I can't say that I brought that into the band, but I did have a pretty good sense of swing, and the band was playing kind of more loudly then. It was It had gone that direction, and so I guess I either fit the bill or I made myself fit the bill. I mean, sure, I was playing with Maynard Ferguson's big band. That was a pretty loud band at the time.
Sure.
And I did my best to combine it with all the things that I love so much about all the earlier recordings of Weather Report, and I was, you know, I'm a huge Zawinul fan. The one thing that I enjoyed from having worked so much in big bands, you know, I'm when I get behind the wheel of the drum set, as it were, generally pretty confident. Mm-hmm. So Zawinul would cast a withering gaze. I would try my best to play the best drums I could for the moment. I didn't always understand. It was interesting because Joe would often ask for more, and my initial thought, more volume or more notes or more what? Wasn't even more intensity. I think what he was asking for, but didn't know how to ask for, was more intention, mm-hmm. or specificity. This is what I try to teach my students. It's all about the intention. So it's very similar to the process of acting, mm-hmm. and how directors speak to actors. And I hear that, you know, my daughter's an actress, but I also did some work scoring some theatrical pieces, and I would hear that over and over from directors. You need to be more specific. I need, what's your intention here? What's it? And I find that if I'm just sort of aware musically of my intention or being specific, because it's a compositional process, That's, I mean, that's the beauty of jazz. It's, mm-hmm. We're composing as we go along. It's so much fun. If I'm not being specific or playing with intention, then chances are pretty good I'm playing out of some kind of muscle habit, mm-hmm. Or playing out of a place where I'm trying, like, gosh, Steve Gadd, Dave Weckl, Vinnie Caliuta, Simon Phillips, Ryan Blade, and 19 other drummers just walked into the club. I better play something kind of cool or flashy or whatever. Mm-hmm. That would take me out of my game. That would be just like a great tennis player. Oh, you know, instead of paying attention to the ball, they're looking at some tennis legend that just sat down at Wimbledon. Mm-hmm. That's how you lose the match.
Tell me about, I'm a huge ECM fan, a huge Manfred Eicher fan, and you did a lot of recording with Manfred. Mm. Can you give us a little insight on to his genius?
Well, part of his genius just rests with his ears, because he's just got a great set of ears. The other part of his genius, Machiavelli, may have been on occasion, was that if he sensed a comfort level, let's say a sort of creative smugness almost, mm-hmm. he knows how to pull the rug out from under that as well as anyone. And I was curious about it at first, but then it made perfect sense because I started thinking about some of my favorite old jazz albums. And you would see that they were recorded in one afternoon at Rudy Van Gelder's studio. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes these combinations of players, and you could kind of figure out or intuit that not everyone was maybe their most comfortable in that setting for whatever reasons, the challenges, the combination of players. And yet there's something more revealing, more truthful, more honest about music made in that circumstance than, you know, if someone has the opportunity to spend 3 months on an album, let's say, mm-hmm. Which is a legitimate and great way to make a recording as well. But I guess it's almost like comparing theater to a Spielberg piece. Mm-hmm. And so I like theater more, and I love how revealing Manfred's recordings are, not just sonically, but somehow musically. That seems to be his genius to me, and I wish I could have done more work with him. The divide, I think, occurred in great part because of my impatience and not wanting to wait to do a next project. And that's when I started my own little record label. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I can't compare how, I'm sure more people have heard my work. Well, this is before the internet. You know, on ECM recordings than my own label. Now, probably the most people have heard me play some like really fucked up concert somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you can't listen to ECM recordings, for instance, on Spotify.
I know.
So there's, you know, with the 30 million subscribers that they have, there's a lot of people missing out on that music. And the interesting thing, what I find brilliant about Manfred, and I believe it was intentional, and that is you can listen to an album from 30 years ago and listen to an album that they released today. And there is a certain benchmark of quality, but also it has almost, it's agnostic to the time period.
Michael, I missed the last 20 seconds.
Okay, I'll repeat it because I want to get the one of the things I love about ECM and Manfred's style, and that is you can listen to an album from 30 years ago and listen to an album that maybe they released this year. And it's agnostic to the time period, and it's often, with the exception of some albums that were released on ECM, the technology doesn't date it, where it, you know, an album from 30 years ago sounds very, very current. There's no sounds that would make it sound as if it's from the late 70s or 80s.
Gotcha.
And that's something that I think, you know, 50 years from now, I think people will take notice that there wasn't a time stamp on it, like a lot of jazz that we, especially more contemporary jazz, that we hear today, where you can listen to a certain artist, musician, and say, oh yeah, that was recorded in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, timeless.
Yeah, it's very timeless.
Most of the weather report stuff, even though there are era or time-specific stamps because of the latest synth technology on it, they're much like Beatles songs. You know, they're same kind of timeless quality. Wow, you know, my ECM experience began from the first solo piano albums that Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett made, the volume one and two of Solo Piano of Chick's and Facing You by Keith. And then, you know, I went on tour with Stan Kenton, and on the road I would listen, you know, I would make cassette dubs from the vinyl LPs. Whenever the band would be in New Jersey, I could go to my parents' house and I'd hook up my cassette player to the home stereo.
Mm-hmm.
I would fill my suitcase every European tour with ECM albums. They weren't so easy to find in the States back in 72, 73.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seemed like it wasn't so hard to find them. I think Polydor began distributing them.
Mm-hmm.
I found it was inspiring. It was comforting. It was great comfort music for me. And I also found it very romantic, and it just fed my imagination in pleasant ways. So it was really fun to get to work with him. And I have a great admiration for Manfred.
Yeah. Well, and then I guess this is a good time to bring up, there's a ECM box set that is just coming out with your work, Trio. And I actually got a JPEG of the cover. And it seems to be this will be a collector's item, because I remember those albums, and they were brilliant.
Oh, thank you. They were a special time. And now that pianist John Taylor is no longer with us, it's a good time to listen again to how brilliant he was.
Mm-hmm.
The four albums have not been available for a while, and so this repackaging of the four albums in one box set is very welcome. That was it was an interesting trio in that, you know, it's a piano trio, yet it was kind of booked under my name, and not only at the invitation of Manfred, but when we would do touring, and I think there was some notoriety that my name was enjoying, so we were getting some good bookings. But I also assumed the responsibility not only for booking the damn tours and hotels and all that crap, but for setting some kind of tone. And the one thing I was trying to do was, and we used to talk about this, we did a lot of gig postmortems, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't need, every solo didn't need to be an event. You know, as we develop our artistic directions and skills, and we stop wrestling with the instruments so much, you know, during that process, solos are have this arc of, like Michael Brecker used to call it, getting it in the fifth gear. Mm-hmm. You know, and Michael loved getting the solo into fifth gear. And I remember he and I used to talk about it, because he would sense I didn't want to go there, and he'd say I like it to go into fifth gear, and I was already even in steps. I was like, I don't know, you know, I've kind of been there, done that, and so by the time I started the ECM thing, I was really looking to get this more kind of through composed improvisational thing happening. And the guys were good sports of following that kind of thing. So I think that's part of the charm of those albums. And of course, part of making an ECM record is that what you hear in your headphones is pretty much what the final listener will hear. So with that space, the reverb, it affects the choices you make playing wise.
Yeah, I you know, I think the what I remember from those records, now I'm going to date myself calling them records, when they came out, having a certain feel, a certain style, it put you in a certain mood. And that was really what I always enjoyed about ECM, in that it's not so much a level of quality, which is certainly there, but there's a certain feel that you get when you put on those recordings that is missing in so much other music.
You know, my father hated those recordings from this. He just said, you should be doing more drumming on these. Yeah, I remember the first tune on the You Never Know album was something we recorded near the end of the 2 days session. And John said, let's try this tune of mine. And I'm playing through the whole thing, and I don't think I ever played the bass drum once. Maybe mm-hmm. once. And it goes on for a while, and as you're playing it, you know that the song, there's no short way to play the tune. I mean, the tune has a shape, and we took the first take. We used the first take, which I love. In general, I love when first takes make it onto a recording, that you get to share that sense of discovery. But I remember thinking, you know, fuck it, Manfred's probably gonna make this the first fucking tune on the album while I was playing it. And in fact, he did. So anyway.
Well, the while we're on projects that are current, one of the things that I kind of epitomizes what we talked about before, and that is there's this new ECM box set out, but at the same time, you have your Dr. Record, which I want to talk about, and you have this big band album. And then you created an app. So rather than inundate you with a lot of questions at once, maybe let's talk about Dr. Because that really brought me back to the weather report days.
Well, I hope you're hearing me okay. I'm having a little trouble hearing you. But the let's see. So Dr. Is a play on words, and it was an opportunity and kind of a mission-specific endeavor to go back to playing music that had more drums, certainly way more than the ECM albums, to kind of flex my muscles a bit and have fun. So the quest of the album was also to it was called Dr. Om and the Lost Pages. We wanted to give music a first or second hearing that we felt had been denied. Give a chance for some tunes to be heard. So we do a rarely performed Gary McFarlane tune. We did a Zavala tune that was pretty much unknown to most listeners. We did a tune from Weather Report's final album that Jocko and I made together, a song called Speechless, a great Zavala ballad that I'd never heard anyone else cover. Stuff like that. A tune of mine that actually got rejected from that first ECM album called Hawaii Bathing Suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this tune's okay. Let's give it a fresh shot. So that's what Dr. Om was. Dr. Om's really just a celebration. And it was a lot of fun to make. John Beasley was a wonderful co-producer. We just did a second recording. And I think it's even better than the first. Meanwhile, this Bob Minter big band album is the all LA band.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone's heard the Buddy Rich Rant tapes, they'll appreciate the eye wink or the tip of the hat that we make to Buddy, with all LA band. Bob and I have known each other since my Interlochen Arts Academy days, since 1969. And we've worked together almost all these years. We're both professors now at USC. And Bob agreed to collaborate with me on this new play-along app,
mm-hmm.
called Minster Big Band Essentials. I've started this app company, and we have several apps out, play-along, where it's not MIDI and it's not a stupid rhythm section, but a great rhythm section. And it could function as a karaoke for other instrument players, or a rhythm section player could minus the tracks. Mm-hmm. We have a mixer built in. It's for iPhone and iPad. Well, I wanted to do a big band app that not only where you could minus the rhythm section, but you could minus the solos, you could minus lead trumpet. Nothing so unusual there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not every trumpet player is cut out to be a lead player. What about someone that wants to get their section skills together? So we made music minus second trumpet. And we have first alto, tenor, baritone, sax minus, first trombone, bass trombone, plus all the rhythm instruments. So this is quite a thing to record. The manner and process of recording with this amount of separation allowed us to make a big band album that just, it sounds really great.
Mm-hmm.
And the engineer was like, you guys got to make it. You got to put this out as a CD. So that's what we did. So the All LA Band is the fruit of the work that we put into creating this app, but it's for people that either don't want to bother with the app or don't have an iPhone or iPad. You can listen to it in your car or wherever you are.
For the more serious, I guess maybe classical or traditional type of musician that wants to read the charts, are they available too?
Yeah, the charts are included in the iPhone and iPad. You can print them out from your device. You can also record yourself playing along and then post it social media, send it to your friends, send it to your teacher. What we endeavored to do, like if a school system has, a classroom full of iPads and are all registered to the same account, they can all have this material for just the cost of the one purchase.
Wow.
And in fact, the Big Band app is free. You get two songs, kind of like a freemium thing. You get the app and two songs at no cost, and if you want to get more songs, there's 10 songs total.
And I like the intentional Freudian slip of the spelling of Minter for the app, because it's very, text savvy. There's no reason to put an E in Minter. because you know it's Mincer by just being M-I-N-T-Z-R.
Well, Bob wasn't completely thrilled with that, but we did it earlier with Erskine just because of the limited amount of space when you're creating these app icons. Uh-huh. And a graphic designer thought, let's make the primary letters bigger. And so we kind of did the Mincer one just to keep the motif going. I hope it doesn't confuse anyone. But yeah, there's only one Mincer, and there's only one Bob Mincer, and he's great.
My kids would probably correct me and probably say, you know, Dad, it should have been just M N T Z R.
Oh, we have the I in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, your kids are right.
They always are. Well, I want to, if it's okay, I was going to leave you with one story that I've told people before, because as you know, Peter, you're my favorite drummer of all time. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you are. And I think it's the love and the versatility and the, you know, obviously with your history that you've told everyone today, it's wonderful. And to illustrate that, I remember when Steely Dan, when Donald and Walter decided to go back on the road, 25 years ago, let's say, I can't remember the year it was. I was actually on vacation in the islands in St. Lucia. And I said, you know what? I'm going to cut my trip short. I forget how you and I got in contact, but I knew you were touring with them. And I said that I'm going to go to the Omni in Atlanta to see this show, because I had not seen Steely Dan in decades. And when I got backstage, I showed my business card and they said, Michael Fagan from Jazz Is, are you here to see Donald or Walter? And I said, I'm here to see Peter Erskine.
Yeah,
fantastic. Well, Peter, again, I'm sorry it's been so long since we've connected, but let's not drop this ball. Let's keep it going.
Okay, positively, and please, the next time Rabbit appears on the menu, you knock yourself out.
Will do. All right, be well.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, bye.